Today in Europe, this is the time of day when the Columbia Broadcasting System calls in the CBS representatives abroad for the reports direct from Europe. Shortly, we shall have the report from the capital of Belgium, given by Eric Severide, but first here's brief news from Shanghai. The Japanese forces are withdrawing from the entire Chungshan district of South China. It was announced today. This withdrawal was ascribed to a desire by former Chinese Premier Wang Qingwei that the Japanese shorten their battle lines. And we take you now to Brussels.
Eric Severide speaking from Brussels. I'd like to tell you, first of all, what a change it is to come to a neutral city. I can look out of the studio window and see streets blazing with light, and that alone gives one a sense of relief after weeks in the oppressive darkness of Paris. I don't see armed guards pacing back and forth out there, and I don't see anybody with a gas mask over his shoulder. I haven't seen public monuments and statues walled up to the eyes with sandbags. Brussels lies in the heart of the wide and fertile Belgian plain, which has been a battleground of the great powers for centuries. It is only a few minutes' flight from potentially enemy territory. But the city lies open and, from all outward signs, unafraid. The place looks prosperous and intensely busy with peacetime business. And the one restriction which seems to annoy people is a 10 o'clock shutdown of cafes and cabarets. After a drive around much of the country's frontiers, I would say that Belgium is physically prepared for attempted invasion. But talking with people in the little towns and officials here in the capital, you have the definite impression that Belgians are mentally relaxed and fairly confident. People feel more and more that they can stay out of this war. I think that's a natural state of mind after 5 weeks of war around them, into which they have not yet been drawn. But the future will decide if this feeling is justified. In August 1914, Brussels was hysterical with enthusiasm. The people marched off to war with an army that had exactly 102 machine guns and no heavy artillery. 3 weeks later, after a short but fierce struggle, rivers of gray-clad German troops streamed through the streets of Brussels in an endless parade that the people never forgot. Today, the Belgian army is different, and the spirit of the people is different. If Belgium went to war tomorrow, there would be no scenes of mob hysteria. There would be no violent demonstrations against nationals of the enemy country. I think Belgians would defend themselves with less hate and more efficiency. But they want to remain neutral and at peace. Premier Pirlo called in reporters the other day and said he believed the army was 5 to 6 times better than in 1914. He said, "Let's beware of words of hate. It is not possible to use the language of war and at the same time to remain at peace." Tonight, a Foreign Office official said to me, "If you broadcast, tell Americans that we have not forgotten what America did in the last war for us, and tell them we, as they, want a just and lasting peace in Europe." The neutrality of Belgium was arranged by the great powers 100 years ago, and that lasted until the World War. In 1936, the Belgians broke their official military contacts with France. Their independence is now assured by France, England, and Germany, provided they defend their frontiers uniformly. But today, if Germany asks why more Belgian troops are on her frontier than on the French frontier, Belgians are entitled to reply that the placing of troops is their own internal affair. As a neutral state trying to keep its commerce going, Belgium still keeps its frontiers open on all sides, and Frenchmen, Germans, and Englishmen move in a constant stream in and out of the country. As a democratic state, Belgium keeps its press uncensored and allows all political groups to continue their own propaganda. The lobby of my hotel is always full of foreigners, reporters, businessmen, diplomats, and agents of all the great powers. Only 2 or 3 extra English and French journalists have turned up. But it's interesting to point out that many German journalists who had to leave France and England have settled here in Brussels. I'm told there are 31 of them here now, and the staff of the German embassy itself has been enlarged. The German Information Service here publishes a news release 5 times a day, while the English only publish once. German newspapers often get here quicker than the British, although French papers arrive promptly and Belgian newspapers print a good deal of news from Paris. There are few uniforms on the street here, and you have to drive into the country before you get any visual confirmation of the fact that this country is 50% mobilized for war. More than 300,000 men are under arms, and if the government calls for full mobilization, that figure will jump to 800,000. Belgium had a full dress rehearsal last year during the Czech crisis. This year, she has had 5 weeks to put herself on the alert. Today, the defense system is manned on every frontier, including that with Holland and on the North Sea coast. In 1914, she was caught off balance. Then the troops lacked training and equipment. After a couple of days' march, for example, their boots wore through. The invasion and 4 years' occupation was a bitter lesson. Since then, Belgium has labored and spent millions so that the same thing will not happen again. The task of the army is simplified, first, because it needs think only of defense and not of attack. Second, because on the German side, the defense line is rather short. And third, by the magnificent barriers nature and engineering have given the country. This time, if invaded from the east, I think the Belgian army would not make the mistake it made before. The same mistake the Poles made, of trying to defend the frontier itself. Instead, they will fall back into the defendable positions. A map will show them to you. In the southeast is the Ardennes region. It is mountainous, the roads are narrow, and the rivers cut deep gorges. An invader would move slowly and painfully here. Further back is the River Meuse. The bridges are mined, and concrete gun emplacements line the west side. At Liège, rivers, railways, and highways come together. And here is the pathway into the Belgian plain, and the key to Belgian defense. Further north, concrete pillboxes, 3 to the mile, line the river up toward the Dutch frontier. At last, there is the Great Albert Canal, which cuts across from this point toward Antwerp, far to the west and north. Parts of this canal can be flooded, and the rest strongly defended. You can see that Belgian defense is an engineering problem. The army knows this, and in the Ardennes, for example, troops get 6 weeks training in demolition work. Dynamite is their weapon, and their own bridges and roads their objectives. Sunday morning, we drove along the cobbled highways with their curbings like a city street and the neat bicycle paths beside them. And in every town, the people were at worship, and bicycles formed a cluster around each little church. Milk carts stood in the streets with the dogs at pulling, waiting patiently in harness. When the church hour had passed, we found each village full of soldiers in khaki, young, ruddy-faced boys who wore capes with a tassel in the front. In Liège, where the forts held up the German army for days in 1914, in a siege which history will never forget, everybody was busy with his Sunday activities. The odds and ends market was going full blast along the river, and a traveling carnival was ready to open. Clusters of boys and girls in scout uniforms were climbing in and out of streetcars. No gas masks here. Hardly a sign even to indicate an air raid shelter. I came across a white notice pasted on a brick wall. It was dated September 2nd and signed by the burgomaster. He asked the people to remain calm and said, "Our army is ready and will fulfill its duty." Two bridges here had been accidentally exploded a few days before. And we saw one of them, lying foundering in the river, with its steel arches sticking out, while river tugs massed around it. Beyond the city are the rings of forts. They are modernized now and painted green like the landscape, with rounded gun cupolas, stretches of rusted barbed wire, and stubble fields of anti-tank rails planted in front of them. But there's one rather medieval touch, and that's the deep tank moat which runs around the fort. In this region, the Belgian army has defense positions disguised as little huts. The windows look like glass, but are really steel shutters. When we move down into the Ardennes region around Oyken and Malmedy, there is an astonishing change here in the terrain. Suddenly, you find yourself in pine forests with steep hills rising up around you. The region has a wilderness feeling about it. Villages are far apart and seem empty and desolate under a gray sky. We began to run a gauntlet of barricades on the road. Wherever there was a bridge or a spot where it was impossible to leave the road, we found one. Sometimes they were just piles of newly cut pine logs and brush. Some were made out of layers of rocks, and the cement was still wet. In each case, they were formed in zigzag, so that you had to come to a full stop and then cautiously twist your car around them. They are designed, of course, to slow down invading troops. And always beside the barricade was a little wood or brush hut with an armed guard sitting before an open fire. Sometimes there was a sign which read, "No smoking," and you noticed a deep hole in the road which was roped off from approach, and the hole, you assumed, was a dynamite. At one barricaded bridge, we stopped and talked to the guards. Across the bridge, the forest was in German territory. The guards were friendly and casual. They loaned us their binoculars and pointed out a clearing in the distance where men were working. That was the Siegfried Line, a part of it, getting some finishing touches. paid particular attention to the map, since one man in the car had a British passport, and it would have been embarrassing, to say the least, to cross the line by mistake and run into a German patrol. A patrol of two Belgian soldiers stopped us. They seemed hungry for company and put their feet up on the running board and talked with us a long time. They had a perfectly relaxed air, as though nothing had happened and nothing ever would happen. They told us that now and then, in the middle of the forest, they ran into German frontier patrols. There were always three men in the German patrol. And when they met, the third German soldier always stepped back into the trees to watch. And the Belgians laughed about that. They often talked with the German guards and heard from them even the official German argument that they wanted no war with France, which wanted no war with France, which was official German argument, that they wanted no war with France, which was official Germany. The Germans liked to make jokes about Mr. Chamberlain's umbrella. The young German soldier insisted France and England, not Germany, had invaded Belgium in 1914. That's the way they had learned their history. Back on the main highway, not far from Aix-la-Chapelle, we approached the German line again. The Belgian custom guards again chattered and smoked with us on the road. We walked a little way toward the German side, where a wide streak of white paint across the highway divides Belgium from the German Empire. Two men in gray Reichswehr uniform and steel helmets were there. They were remarkably big, square-built men. As soon as they saw us, they separated. Each took a side of the road and stood stiffly at attention, their eyes fixed upon us. After the casualness of the Belgian, that seemed to stop and gesture. It impressed me with the fact that across this streak of white paint, a new empire began. A new kind of society. And a moral atmosphere that reached from that point far to the east. And now I suppose it stretches eastward to Vladivostok and the Pacific. This is Eric Severide speaking from the capital of Belgium and returning to Columbia in New York.
That was the report from Brussels, and now in the few seconds remaining, perhaps I can amplify the news that I gave you earlier from Shanghai, which said the Japanese forces are withdrawing from the entire Chungcheong district of South China. This withdrawal followed a similar movement from the Changsha area of Hunan province, and it is ascribed in Shanghai to a desire by former Chinese Premier Wang Qingwei that the Japanese should shorten their battle lines in advance of new peace moves and the possible launching of a new central government for the Japanese-occupied areas of China. Chungshan, you may recollect, is the Chinese Holy Land. It's the birthplace of the late Dr. Sun Yat-sen, founder of the modern Chinese state, and is the homeland of many Chinese residents of the United States. That is the first news we've had in some time from Shanghai. At 8:55 Eastern Time, CBS, you know, brings you the nightly broadcast of Elmer Davis and the news. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.